Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. It's Thursday night. This is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. I am Jim Christina in studio with the lovely, vivacious Bobby Jean Bell. Her husband, Jim, who's walking all over the place taking pictures.
Yes.
Of course, he is our photographer of record. And Bobby.
Yes.
You sound immensely better than you did earlier this week.
Well, the day you called me Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock, I'd been up pretty late working on some things, but you had called me that morning with such amazing news.
I know. I was so stoked. I couldn't wait.
You couldn't wait. So what did make my phone ring at 8 o'clock Tuesday morning?
Your phone rang at 8 o'clock Tuesday morning because Craig Johnson, who is the creator of Walt Longmire, agreed to come onto the show, and we gave him January 7th.
We are so excited.
Oh, my gosh. It's huge, because we were talking about this last week because Walt Longmire came back last week.
Yes.
So it was, like, totally stoked, and I'm just, like, beside myself now.
And we sell a shirt on our website that is produced by Rock Mount Ranchwear,
mm-hmm.
and it's a denim shirt, and Walt Longmire's character wears it. In several episodes, and we say that about the shirt, and it's interesting because we've had like 5 orders for this shirt in the last like 3 days.
Well, I just apologize for them beforehand because nobody can be Walt Longmire.
Well, it's a great shirt.
Why don't you introduce our in-studio guest tonight?
I am thrilled to do that. We have with us a friend of yours and mine, a gentleman that we've both known for quite a long time. Peter Schirico, recognized Western historian and author, is best known for his work on Western movies like Tombstone and television programs like Wild West Tech for the History Channel, where his passion for the West and Westerns is clearly reflected. The performer and entrepreneur served as technical consultant and supplier to programs such as The Truth of Jesse James and Billy the Kid for Discovery Channel and Deadwood for HBO. His company, Caravan West Productions, provides horses and other livestock, weapons, uniforms, cannons, costumes, period saddles and tack, everything you possibly would need if you were doing any type of a production relating to the American Civil War, the Gold Rush, Wild West, Old West, and so forth. An avid reader and researcher, Peter's personal Western library rivals most museums' archives. He describes himself as the big kid that never grew up. I love horses, dogs, and children, not necessarily in that order. And I've learned that some of the best lessons in life can be learned from an incredibly smart horse and a really great dog. Please welcome to the Writer's Block Radio Show an author with more degrees than a thermometer, Peter Schirico. Welcome, Peter.
Oh, thanks, Pete. There you go.
All right, settle down. I'll have to throw everybody out of here.
That's all right. I like this crowd. It's a good crowd.
Didn't you tell me once you have 4,000 books, Western books?
Yeah, probably, but now I have 5,000.
Or more.
It's been a few years back.
I just came back on my trip, and I think I picked up another 30-some books. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your trip, Peter. I understand it was 28 states. In 2 weeks?
28 states in 2 weeks, sleeping in the car most of the time, just getting up. I know where all of the great flea markets are around the country. I look for them. I find the stuff. I take the back roads. I don't travel the interstate highways. Well, I do once at night when you can't see anything. And I just buy. So I left here with an empty van, and I came back with a full van and a new dog.
Well, there you go. The story of your life.
Now, one of the reasons, though, that you're making those kinds of trips is because of Caravans West Productions.
Right.
Besides just having a personal interest. But
I have a passion for the West, and I want to make the West look good. the other prop houses or costume places, they just have people working for, you know, I'm working, that's a job. And they don't really care about it. So when a show comes into them, they have to look for the stuff. And if a producer says, well, I need something special for this, whether it's a gun or a gun belt or a piece of clothing or a hat or a style, they don't have it. They have to make it. And then it costs them an arm and a leg to do it. And they have no time to do it. So when I have an opportunity, I usually travel around the country 2 or 3 weeks a year and look for the stuff. And I know that it's going to work. Now, I might not use it for a year. But I know it's right for a Western. It's right to put in. It's the correct thing, whether it's a piece of furniture or a saddle or a gun belt or a gun or little spurs, saddlebags, whatever I can find at these places. And then I always like to call it American Pickers, a TV show. Next to me, they're pikers.
Because the American pikers.
Yes, they're picking. I want this and I want that. I'll go, how many you got? Let me have them all. Like I was at this place in Texas Tuesday, and I just threw holsters into a box. I don't know how many there are. There might be 100. There might be 98. There might be 150. I don't know. I just threw them in the box, and I said, okay, I'm taking them all. I'll buy them all.
Now, because of Caravan West Productions, which is your, tell us a little bit more about Caravan West Productions and what you do there.
25 I had this name for a long time, and I wanted to do something that is fulfilling. You know, Mark Twain said it best about, he said, a man, there are two important days in his life, the day he's born and the day he finds out why. And my whole attitude in life is I love movies. I love the entertainment industry. I've been in it for years. I grew up watching movies, going to all the cowboy shows, watching every Western on TV, and I have this passion for the West. It's a magical place to me. And I'm one of those guys that watched a movie, watched a TV show, and say, well, that's not the right gun. That's not the, look at the, where did, that holster didn't exist then. That's that, what are they doing? And as I became more involved in the business, I kept on seeing that the people supplying them, A, didn't know what was right, mm-hmm. or B, didn't care, or C, went to find the cheapest thing possible. So, yes, if you go to a top prop house in town, they'll say, oh, yes, we can get that silver-mounted slick fork saddle that resembles Buffalo Bill's, but it's going to cost you $10,000. And the producer goes, well, I only have $300 in my budget. Can't do it. Let's find a $200 saddle, which is a modern saddle that I find at yard sales for $75. Mm-hmm. So over the years, I took my hobby of collecting the Old West, and I said, let me start putting this in movies. Let me start putting in the right guns. So that's why when we did the movie Tombstone, I designed all the guns by using my library, by going to the books and saying, Virgil Earp carried this gun. Here is the authenticity behind it. Wyatt Earp had this. Oh, look, Johnny Ringo had this gun. And then I would design them, and then I went to go to... I have friends, I have people that, because of this business, they make saddles, they make gun belts, they make things, they make all of the spur straps and stuff. And I would go to them and say, make me this. This is what I want. So even though I'm not necessarily using it, there's a book out called Packing Iron, which is the Bible of...
We have that book.
And everybody should have that.
Yeah,
we own that book. That's actually a great book.
So I took that book and I bought 5 copies of it, mm-hmm. and I went to my 5 different guys who make holsters for me, and I would say, make this one on this page, make me these, so that when you come to our warehouse full of gun belts and holsters, I can show you where they are from Packing Iron. I can show you where they are from any number of books that shows you what Jesse James holster looked like, mm-hmm. what Frank James holster was.
And so really, as an author, your first book was the book that celebrated and really put in print what you did for Tombstone, the guns and the gear.
Yeah, I knew when I was making that movie that it was going to be a classic because the writer, the first director, Kevin Jarre, had a passion for the West End and knowledge for it, and he knew what he wanted. He was very, very emphatic about, I want this holster for this person, I want this type of gun for this person, I want this saddle. And he knew what was right. We were at Universal in the beginning, and Universal said, oh, no, you can't use these guys. They have no experience behind it. You have to use this wrangler who had been in the business for 30 years before that. And Kevin called me up, and he said, well, I got to go see this guy. I talked to him, and he said he had 70 period saddles. And if his saddles are right, we're going to use them. So he went off to see him, called me up the next day, and he said, well, he had 70 saddles, but not one of them was a period one. The problem is the guys who are supplying the stuff will lie to a producer. Oh, yeah, that's correct. That's right. There's another wrangler in town that they were doing a show in the 1860s, and they brought him in, and he was bringing in 1960s saddles and telling the prop guy, oh, no, those are 1860 saddles. They've been in 50 movies. They're right. And luckily the prop guy said, no, they're not. And that's what Kevin did. He said, yeah, you have Yeah, period saddle. And what the excuse the guy gave was, he said, oh, well, the old saddles don't fit horses, and actors can't ride them. What he should have said was, he was being politically correct, because what he really meant is actors can't ride. And that's fact, man. Except for me, of course.
Of course.
And a few others. And a few others. But most can't. But they say they can. Mm-hmm. And yes, he was absolutely right in the fact that a saddle that's 120, 130 years old does not fit today's modern horses. Horses back then were 900 pounds. Today they're 1,200 pounds. So the horses were like taking a guy who's a size 36 pants and putting him in a size 32. It's not going to fit right. It's going to be uncomfortable. And that's what they did. So what I did was go to all of these guys who are around the country that I know who also have a passion for the West, who also made saddles, and I said, make me an 1870 Sam Stagg Riggs slick fork. Make me an 1850s Texas Hope saddle. Make me a Mother Hubbard saddle on today's quarter horse bar trees so they fit today's horses, but they look like they're supposed to look. Mm-hmm. Plus, they're not 120 years old because back in 1880, a saddle was new. Saddle wasn't old. We did this one movie, and the lead character in it has a scene. He has $22,000 in the bank. Now remember, this is a time when people made 10 cents an hour. He was the bounty hunter, and so he had a lot of money. He bought the bar. There's a scene in the bank where he has $22,000, and I gave him a brand new slick fork saddle. And the director said to me, he says, oh, that saddle is new. I mean, it looks brand new. I mean, why would he? No, I want a saddle. I said, wait a minute. What kind of car do you drive? And he looked at me and he said, well, I drive a Mercedes. Why? I said, why do you drive a Mercedes? He said, because I can afford it. I said, you just said it right there. This man can afford something new. There was another character in the show who was a poor farmer. And I gave him an old saddle with mismatched stirrup leathers, with things that were repaired and replaced by somebody who was, you know, so think of a kid driving around in a 20-year-old car with a different color fender and a light out.
Right.
And that's the way I design things. Mm-hmm. I look at it as an actor. I look at a script and I break down every character like I'm playing that character. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, what would he wear? What would he do? What would he have? Everybody's flashing around.
No, actually,
I've been vaccinated with a photograph. I'm not going to shut up.
I have to cut you off pretty quick. I have to run an ad for our sponsor, but you can sit there and be Peter.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Anyway, quickly before I get to Target Freight, the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing and Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall, and this is our major sponsor right now.
Hey, Jim Christina here for Target Freight Management, the 3PL solution to all your shipping needs. Are you tired of your freight being reclassed? Tired of calling several freight companies for the best rate for your shipments? Then, of course, they reclass you anyway, and there go your rates. And Target Freight Management has a solution for you. Their customized transportation management system protects all of their clients from situations just like yours. If you're currently shipping a density-based product, you need to call Target Freight today. Target Freight is currently saving their clients between 15 and 20% off their freight costs, and that's a huge savings to anyone. They will even do a free cost analysis of your current freight program to see if you are a good fit for their program, and not everyone is. The kicker is, Target Freight is only paid strictly on the contingency they can save you money on your LTO costs. Call Target Freight Management today and just see what they can do for your company. Target Freight Management, 888-653-1323, or catch them on the web at www.targetfmi.com. That's 888-653-1323, Target Freight Management.
And we're back. And if you're just now joining us, we're in the studio with Peter Chirico, the infamous Texas Jack Vermillion from the movie Tombstone, and Caravan West Productions, and several movies. And, oh, I did see Yellow Rock, incidentally.
Yellow Rock, yes.
It was a fun movie.
Michael Biehn kills me that time. He played Johnny Ringo
in
Tombstone.
Yeah.
He didn't get to kill me in that, but he kills me with a pick.
Hey, if you want to call in and talk to Peter, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. What got you into writing, Peter?
John Milius, who has written a lot of movies and produced and directed, I told him years ago, he's been a friend of mine for over 30 years, and I was talking to him, and he's such a great writer. And he told me one line that lived with me. And he said, before you write anything, have something to say. And I kept on thinking about, okay, what do I want to do? What do I want to share with people? And another guy told me one time, he said, there are three types of people in the world. There are givers and takers and sharers. And the first two are losers. So you want to share. And I have this knowledge that I have amassed over the years, and I want to share it with other people who are like-minded in it, but they can't, they can't do it, or they won't do it. Mm-hmm. So I just sat down. It takes me forever to write a book. I wrote it takes me about 2 years. Mm-hmm. I'm writing another one right now called Hoppy and Me, Life's Lessons from the Silver Screen, and everything that I learned from Hopalong Cassidy, and how to live life. And I live my life like the stuff I learned from Gene Autry and Roy Rogers and Hopalong Cassidy and The Lone Ranger. That's how I live my life. And for movies, I love movies. So there's a line that Joel McRae uses in Ride the High Country, which I enjoy that movie.
That's one of my very favorite movies, actually.
But he says, I want to enter my house justified. Mm-hmm. And that is the way I live my life. I never do anything that I'm not ashamed of, that I'm afraid to show my face.
No, that you are ashamed of.
Was that a Freudian?
Possibly.
I was just thinking
you heard
about,
it here.
I was just thinking about being seen with a 19-year-old girl. I was just seen with a 28-year-old model one time. We went into to a dinner for the sheriff, and they all looked at me, and I said, I know what you're thinking. I'm either very rich or she's my daughter. Well, neither.
Well, you know, a lot of people in show business, celebrities, they all put out these books, but they're all ghostwritten. For a majority of them, very few of them, I think, write their own stuff. And you've actually jumped out of that, and you've written all your own stuff, and I find that admirable.
I have been yelled at by people. You're a micromanager. You're a control freak. You're everything else. Yes, I do this because when we do a show and we're doing the props, the set dressing, the horses, the costumes, the guns, the buckaroos, mm-hmm. the background people, I'm doing all of that stuff. Plus, I'm acting it or I'm stunt coordinating it. These are things that I do because I love it. So, yes, I do micromanage those things. And I said, okay, if I'm going to write something, I'm going to write it for me. And I don't write I write the way I speak. So it's like me talking
yes,
to you.
Yes, you do.
I don't, I'm not going to sit
that's
there.
That's not a bad thing.
No.
You
know,
I'm not going to sit there and do something. And I hate I love getting advice from other people, but I don't like people telling me, this is the way it has to be done. My attitude in life is, no, it has to be done the way I feel comfortable doing mm-hmm. it, the way people can sit down and sit down and have a glass of bourbon with me and a cigar, and we'll sit there and enjoy it and do it that way. So that's the way I do it.
Yeah, well, that's good.
It takes me forever to do it.
Well, I mean, it's admirable that you do it that way, and that, I mean, you've come up with some great stuff, and you know, Neo and or also in Neo, that was, you know, a cute little story.
Yes, my boys. Well, that was, you know, it's funny. I'm at a gun show, so I go to gun shows, and I buy stuff at gun shows, and I sell stuff at gun shows. And I'll tell people, if they see me walking around buying stuff, I'm working. I have a job. If they see me selling stuff, I need a job. So I either have to get a job or pull a job. And I was selling my children's books.
Oh,
and a guy walked by, and he went, "You make cowboy movies. What are you selling children's books for?" And I said, "Look, when I was a kid, I grew up with Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. They taught me my lifestyle." Mm-hmm. I said, "It's my turn now." So this was something that I had to give them. And my horse was with me for 27 years. My dog, who's with me all his life, is born in my bedroom. And I learned so much from them. I learned so much about love and appreciation and how to share your life with someone. And so I just started creating all of these little stories that would make life fun. Like, there was a horse of a different color. And it's where my dog is confused because he sees horses of all different colors. And he says, I see a white horse and a black horse and a brown horse and a yellow horse and a red horse. And my horse starts laughing at him. And he was a paint, so he was. I said, "Look at me, I'm two colors." He said, "All horses are different colors." And then they go through all the things that horses do, whether it's pulling a wagon or a plow or riding or jumping scenes or in a rodeo or whatever the horse has to do. And then my dog starts laughing and smiling, and my horse, what are you so happy about? He said, "Well, I just realized that there are small dogs and medium dogs like me, and there are large dogs." And then they go through a whole series of service dogs and what dogs do and, you know, how they protect and how they help people. And the whole moral behind that book is that it doesn't matter what color you are or what size you are. It's what you do that counts.
Yeah.
So those are those little morals that I try to put in the kids' books, and I hope that they learn something from them.
No, I hope so too.
Oh, you're looking at me.
I am.
I'm just having such a great time listening. Oh, before you
get started, you had told me years and years ago a story about when you were filming the saloon scene in Tombstone.
Yeah, which saloon scene? The one I'm drunk in?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Can you relate that story? It was you and Buck Taylor.
After the Air Force, after Vietnam, after I went to college, I was a method. I'm a method actor. You know what a method actor is?
Absolutely.
Really? Mm-hmm. The definition of a method actor is someone who's standing on 42nd Street, New York, in a rainstorm, urinating in his pants. He knows what he's doing, but nobody else does. And so I'm a prop actor. I love to do things. And so Val Kilmer and I had a very good relationship. Before I get into the saloon stuff, I'll tell you the story with Val. First day of shooting, everybody warned me about him. Everybody said, don't talk to Val. He hates everybody. He yells. He's angry with everybody. And the prop guy said something to him. And then Val said, "Why are you telling me that?" And he said, "Well, just because I'm telling you that." And Val lit off at him, cursed him, yelled, screamed. And everybody was like, "Ooh, you know, leave him alone." But I realized that he's just a consummate actor. So his little flask that he had with brandy in it had brandy in it. He had all of these things, and he was doing that. And I saw him riding with his gun, and it was half-cocked. And I rode up to him, and I said, "Val, your gun's half-cocked." And he looked at me, and he said, "Yeah? Why? So what?" And I said, "Well, if someone sees the movie and they see a gun half cocked in your holster, they're going to know you don't know how to handle a single action. You're going to either break the gun or you're going to hurt yourself." And he said, "I find those who break the rules get ahead, don't you?" And I went, "Okay, this is Val Kilmer. I'm not going to argue with him." So I rode away. Within 5 minutes, I looked over and he had a different gun in his holster. I rode over to the armorer who worked for me, and he's fixing Val's gun. I said, "What happened?" He said, "Val broke his gun." I said, "Oh." And I rode back over to Val, and I look at him, and I go, "Hey, I see you have a different gun." And he looked at me and smiled with a little smirk. He said, "I broke it." And he knew then that I knew what I was talking about. So when we're doing the saloon scene, mm-hmm. and Buck Taylor and I come out and kill a guy who's... Mm-hmm. Now, we're supposed to be in the saloon all night long. Well, in a saloon all night long, you're drinking and you're gambling. So I was drinking. I had a bottle of bourbon back there, and then we did like five takes, and I was getting progressively drunk. And I came on. So then we're standing in front of the scene with Doc and Wyatt and Virgil, and the sheriff comes over and takes our guns away and puts us in jail. And Val kept on looking at me. And then later on in the afternoon, I'm walking down the street, and Val's sitting over there on the street, and he looked at me and goes, "Hey, Pete, come here." I go, "Yeah." He goes, "You were drunk in that scene, weren't you?" And I looked at him and I said, "I find those who break the rules get a hit." We were the best of friends on that show.
Where was that film shot? Where was that?
We shot in Mezcal, which was a town that they built in 1969 from Old Tucson Studios. We did Old Tucson Studios, and then we did a place called the Baba Kamari Ranch, which was like 80,000 acres. That's where we did the scenes with Charlton Heston and all the big riding scenes and so forth.
Yeah, it's still one of my favorite films.
We were in Arizona filming for 17 weeks.
But the theater scene was done in Old Tucson. Old Tucson.
Old Tucson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Quick question.
Yes.
Dead air.
Okay, so why do you think that sharing the story of the West today is still relevant? Whether it's on the big screen, the small screen, the written word, do you think it's still relevant today?
Just like a story of 5,000 years ago. Man has not changed. And if you look at any recorded history of man, we all have the seven deadly sins. Greed, you know, lying, sloth, whatever they are. We still have those. We had them 5,000 years ago. We had them 120, 30 years ago during the Old West. We have them now. If the story is good, and if the characters are good, mm-hmm. and if the directing is good, then you have a good movie. These are things that I look for. I look for a good story with good characters and good directing. And then I call it a cake. We're putting the cake in the oven. We're taking the best ingredients. We're putting it in, and out comes a beautiful cake. So what Caravan West does, we put the icing on the cake. What happened in most Westerns and why they are so terrible is because they're not putting good icing on the cake. They're putting dog doo-doo. It's still a good cake, mm-hmm. but it doesn't taste well.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have done, and I did it single-handedly. I'm the only guy in the world who does what I do. And I want to make it better. I want to make it. If you have a good movie, I will make it better. If you have a great movie, I will make it greater. If you take a good movie or a great movie and then put bad stuff in it, it's not going to improve it. And this is what I try to get to impart to producers. I love it when producers come out to the ranch. If they come out to the ranch, we get the job. If I just talk to them or go to them in a meeting in their office, they don't believe me because they don't think anybody can do what we do. Mm-hmm. But we do.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a question?
I'm just no.
Okay. have you? You've written. We've talked a little bit about some of the books that you've written. Have you done any screenwriting? Do you have some?
I wrote a movies? Of course.
Well.
I have three scripts that have not been produced that I'm still polishing up. I had one that we did in 1998 called Good Men Gone Bad. And again, it's based on real stories. It was in the late 80s, early 90s when ranches were taken over by big business. We all think big business is evil. Big business is evil, and they always have been evil. And big ranches were taken over by English gentlemen, and cowboys were out of work, and they were looking at and things. And the Arabs, our friends, back in the 1870s and 80s, they were going to Mexico to buy blondes and redheads to take over to Saudi Arabia to go into the harems. So what I had the cowboys doing was they were so upset, they had no money, they had no jobs. They, good men who'd gone bad, they stole two sisters from a rancher. And they were taking them to Mexico to sell them to the Arabs.
One of those stories that doesn't really, you know, make it into the headlines of Western history, and there's a lot of those, you know.
There
really are
a lot
of, yeah.
I try to read all of these old books, and I say, mm-hmm. this is a wonderful story. How come mm-hmm. this has never been uh-huh. told? How come this is, you know, nobody thinks about it?
Mm-hmm.
And we all know, we all know that I'm not politically correct.
Well, that is true.
Who have I offended today?
Well, and I'm
certainly not us.
We know when we see you typically, Peter, that you look as though you've just walked off the Wild West stage. You often do a one-man show about Buffalo Bill. Can you tell us a little bit about your fascination with that particular Western icon?
I have always admired Buffalo Bill. The Joel McRae movie, it was then 1943, was on TV in the 50s when I was a little kid. And I watched this movie, and there were certain things about that movie, about Joel McRae's performance, that touched me. There are two movies that really bring a tear to my eye. Me, Mr. Tough Guy, is They Died With Their Boots On. Mm-hmm. I can't watch that movie without...
My mom's favorite movie. And, Mom, I know you're listening.
And Buffalo Bill. And so I've always had a fascination. Now, a lot of people who do reenactments, who create that, they want to be Jesse James, or they want to be Billy the Kid, or they want to be... I like Buffalo Bill. He was an entrepreneur. He wanted to bring the West to the world. He loved the West. He called it God's biggest playground. And that's why I'm a kid. That's never grown up. It's a playground. I am in the playground. And what Buffalo Bill did was he did the things that he did. We are 100 years apart. So we were born 100 years apart. He joined the Union Army in 64 to fight in an unpopular war. I joined the Air Force in 64 and I volunteered to go to Vietnam. He started his stage career in 1872. I started mine in 1972. We were doing it. He spent 10 years on stage before he created the Wild West show. I also spent 10 years on stage in New York doing a lot of theater, a lot of the classics. And then in 82, I moved out to L.A., and then I joined the Wild West show. And my very first performance in the Wild West show, I'm sitting on the horse waiting to go on, and I hear the announcement, and the announcer's going, "Ladies and gentlemen, we want to commemorate this show to Buffalo Bill. It's the 100th anniversary of his performance," and I almost fell off my horse.
I bet you did.
And it's the fact that I do all of these things. I hire the buckaroos. I hire all the background people. I bring in people who have an interest to the West, but they can't. They would love to work on a movie, but they can't, so I hire them. So when we did Deadwood, I had 100 people working on there. When we did Tombstone, all the Red Sash Gang were guys that I hired. So I bring in people with that, and it's the same thing that Buffalo Bill did. He shared his love for the West with the world and brought it out to people.
Yes, he certainly did. We're very much impacted by Buffalo Bill and going to England and traveling throughout Europe
Germany,
as well as
I went to Germany and did my Buffalo Bill show in Germany, which was
it had to be hugely successful.
We were at the Carl May Festival. Uh-huh. Carl May is the guy who went to. And there were 35,000 people at the festival, all dressed up in cowboy outfits, shooting blank pistols. Now, in Germany, they couldn't have real guns, but Uberti, who makes a lot of the guns that we shoot over here, they make a special blank gun that you can only load blanks in. And these guys were running around with it, shooting it up all over the town. It was just a great thing.
Was that in Dusseldorf? That's where his museum is, right?
Yeah. And I went to his museum. It was fascinating.
Is that an annual event, Peter?
It's an annual event.
It is.
And it was wonderful because one of the fascinating things about it is seeing all of these people. And they had so many different acts coming in. They had people all over the place. And Carl May is the guy who invented the sidekick.
Really?
We think of Pat Buttram and all of these other guys. He invented, I can't remember the name of the character, but Shatterhand, his partner, was this little bald-headed guy who wore a wig because you have to have long hair to be a scout. So we did a movie a couple of years ago called Chinaman's Chance. And I'm playing a scout who's going to lead this posse after the bad guys. And, of course, we all can see my hair is not what it was 30 years ago. So I had a wig. And, of course, I wore a wig in Tombstone, too. I was the only guy that was bald that had a wig. Everybody else had hair in there. And I had this wig. So when they're asking me in the bar, and I played Texas Jack, of course. So Texas Jack, we need you to scout and find the guys. And I said, okay, but I'm not ready yet. And I take out of my pocket the wig and I put it on. I said, okay, now I'm ready. And I got that from Winnetou.
Oh, how funny.
Hey, look, we got to run another ad real quick, and we'll be back with Peter.
Hey, Jim Christina here for TFM Truckload, a division of Target Freight Management. TFM Truckload is here to help you with all of your truckload and railroad shipping needs. If you want a reputable company who is going to work hard to find you the best rates while maintaining the best service, then TFM Truckload is who you need to call. When TFM Truckload books a truck for your company, it shows up 100% of the time. So if you want a reliable truckload broker, then call TFM Truckload today. That's TFM Truckload toll-free at 844-653-7789. Or if you're a web guy like me, go to www.targetfmi.com. So give them a call at 844-653-7789 or catch them on the web.
And we are back. You're in the studio with Peter Shirako. And if you're just now joining us, what's taking you so long? We have a question we ask all our writers, Peter, because this is, of course, the writer's block.
Sure.
Have you ever had it?
Mm-hmm. I always look at the writer's block as when the imaginary voices in your head stop talking to you.
That's a really good
That's
way of putting
really
it.
Good
that
one.
Is really a good way to put it.
That's the way I look at it. Yeah, I get ideas, and then I start putting them down. I have notebook after notebook after notebook full of things, and I'm writing all the time. And I'm writing all this stuff down. I say, oh, this would be a great idea for – and then how do I keep on going with it? How do I formulate it? How do I put it together? How do I get a message across? I'm not Western Union, but I want to get a message across. I want to have something that people are going to sit back and say, wow, I learned something today. So, do I have writer's block? Sure.
I think we all do.
Now, when you're writing, we know that we talked a little bit about a couple of the children's books that you've written, and of course, the Tombstone Guns and Gear book. You also wrote a book called The Fringe of Hollywood, The Art of Making a Western. Again, a terrific nonfiction book. Tell us a little bit about that book, and were you doing a lot of writing? You're talking about trying to keep track of your ideas that gave birth to this book?
Basically, it's all of, again, what I want to share. So many people over the years talked about Tombstone, and everybody was arguing, well, Doc Holliday really carried this gun, and he had this holster. And I said, no, I put all the stuff in. I know what they have. I have all the stuff. So I wrote that book so that the audience, and it's a cult movie, that these guys can sit there and say, hey, this is what, who carried what and everything else. And then I'm one of those guys that keep on complaining about Western movies. That's not the right stuff. So because I know what is correct for what period, I put The Fringe of Hollywood together. And, of course, I call it The Fringe of Hollywood because you know me. I'm always in a buckskin coat. I always have fringe. And I am on the outside of the world. When they talk about doing something outside the box, I'm not even near the box because I have my own opinion about everything, and I will voice it. I will not, and again, it's one thing I learned from Roy Rogers. Roy said, and it's on the silver screen, tell the truth no matter what it costs. Mm-hmm. I've told the truth a lot, and it has cost me several jobs. Mm-hmm. But I enter my house justified. I'm not worried about it. And I'll tell these people that, your movie's not going to do well. It's going to fail unless you do it this way, this way, yada, yada, yada. And they don't, no, we don't care. We don't care. We don't care if it's right or not. We're going to get good advertising, and we're going to sell it to them, and they're going to buy it. And they don't. Because I believe the audience is smart. I believe the audience is intelligent, and they want to see something good. And I want to bring that out. So that's why The Fringe of Hollywood is to tell you what guns are correct for what period. I was watching a Roy Rogers movie, and it was Jesse James, and he was in the Civil War, but they were using 92 Winchesters.
Mm-hmm. And 73 Colts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, it's not right. It's not correct. So I'm telling you, if you're going to do a movie, I talk to people all the time. Yeah, so here's the script. Okay, what year is it? Well, it's right after the Civil War. And there's a scene in the brick church, and I said there were no churches. The West was nothing. People started coming out, and the first cattle drive was 1867. The first Jesse James robbery in Liberty, Missouri was 1867. So don't tell me it's 1866, right after the Civil War, and there's a complete town full of bricks and brick-and-mortar town. Mm. It didn't exist. People lived in tents. They lived in canvas things. They lived in signs of wagons. Mm-hmm. They were tent cities. Right. And they just don't understand that. Because what happened is in filming movies, when they started doing movies in the 20s, in the teens, in the 20s, they were using actual old towns. And the old towns still existed, but the old towns didn't come about until the 1890s. The West wasn't settled. If you think about it, after 82, the West changed. Wild Bill Hickok was dead, Billy the Kid was dead, Jesse James was dead. All of this stuff was gone, and now it was just sporadic. And then the railroad came through. Nothing was really built until the railroads came through, mm-hmm. because they could bring the bricks. They could bring the lumber. Mm-hmm. They could bring it. There was a joke I saw in a Playboy magazine back 35 years ago. And it was about these two Indians, and they're on a plateau, and they're looking down. And, of course, it's in the desert, and you see nothing. And there's the fort with all the logs. And one Indian looks at the other one, and he said, "Where do they get all the wood?" And that always fascinated me. Yeah. Here it lives with me.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, where did they get this stuff? They can't have these buildings. But that's what happened in Westerns. And then, of course, the studios, Warner Brothers or Disney or Paramount, Universal, they all built their Western towns. But they were all towns that looked like towns from the 1890s. And then when you try to pawn it off and say it's 1870, no, it wasn't. So we try to, you know, we try to do that. So in the book, I'm going with the guns, with the saddles. Saddles changed. Guns changed. From the Civil War to the turn of the century, guns and saddlery are like computers. Every 6 months, they were out of date. It was gone. When I see a movie, and I've seen several of them, with a Henry rifle, mm-hmm. it's 1890s, and the guy's having a Henry. That's like you going down and buying a new car today and say, "I want an 8-track tape in it. It was good in 1968. I want it now." And they don't realize that, because the director or the actor or the prop guy is going to say, "Hey, that's a good-looking gun. That looks cool. I don't see too many of them." Yeah, you didn't see too many of them in 1895. Mm-hmm. And there were two movies made in the 1890s that have that. There was another show that we did. We did a Angela Lansbury, Murder, She Wrote. And in it, she plays her great-grandmother back in the Civil War. So in the scene, and I'm acting in it, I'm bringing in some stuff. Well, they have the prop guy who's working on it. And the scene calls for one of the characters comes in. And it's 1860, and he says, early 1861, just before the Civil War. But they're gearing up for the Civil War. And he comes in, and he says, "I want to show you my new gun." And everybody oohs and ogles over it. But he brought in a Walker. And I said to the director, he said, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "Well, the Walker was 1847. They only made 1,100 of them, and they were passé. And this is 1860. Now, the new 1860 Army just came out. That's what he should be carrying mm-hmm. in." And the prop guy's going, "Yeah, but the Walker now sells for $150,000, and the 60 Army only sells for $2,000. I said, "Yes, now. But back then, it was brand new." Okay. Then you're looking at the rarity of it for the value of it now. But, you know, so and I won, and he went into the 1860 Army, which makes it
of course you won.
Of course you won.
Exactly. I don't always win.
So I got to ask this question, because you've done so much research and you've been so immersed in so many things. So was Wyatt a good guy or a bad guy, or what's the real story about Wyatt Earp?
He was a guy.
Yeah, he was a guy.
The guy of his time.
He was a boomer, and he didn't want to work. A lot of the boom towns, whether it was Deadwood or Tombstone or Dodge City, there were several groups of people. There were the workers. There were the people with dreams that are going to go out and find that gold mine or that silver mine. And then there were the people who were going to mine the miners. Mm-hmm. And he was a gambler. And yes, they said he ran whorehouses and brothels. Well, that was a respectable job back then. You know, you compare a soiled dove, a lady of the night, to a wife. She makes many men happy, where a wife makes one man miserable.
Susan.
I got to write that. I guess I got to write that one down too.
and the bookie. Yeah.
But that was the nature of life in there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so fascinating when people talk about the Indians, of course, and how we just...
Well, guess who's on the phone? The bookie.
Do we have Jerry on the phone?
Your best friend, Jerry Christina.
Oh, hi, Jerry.
She's not.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to the writer's block.
I knew you were going to call. I just knew it.
I couldn't let this go. I had to wait till the last second. I want to know what he's wearing. Hi, Peter.
You don't want to wait for the pictures later?
No. I have to know now.
I just came back from my trip across country, so I'm wearing my driving clothes.
Yeah, he looks, he's dressed a lot like Jim,
I'm
Christina,
in my radio
and
clothes,
my and my husband Jim. I think they all like what they're all wearing, camp sort of style safari sort of shirts.
Yeah, well, Peter's wearing, you actually know, an Oxford shirt.
Yeah,
L.L. Bean.
There you go, and
I
shorts
it in mail.
And work shoes, I think.
But I'm wearing Buffalo Bill. You know, I'm wearing a jacket with fringe and beads because I figured that's what Peter would be coming in, Jerry.
That's right, and because,
well,
I'm on the radio, I'm
no,
sitting here naked.
No, I figured the plaid shirt and the cargo shorts and the,
nope,
tennis shoes and a cigar.
Not,
yeah,
tonight,
you
he dressed up.
You got the cigar and the shorts, right?
But not the cargo shorts.
Well, listen, I know time is short. I'm going to let you go, but I just had to call.
Thanks.
So good to hear from you.
Talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, so that was a little bit about Wyatt. You must have at least one more great question.
Who, me?
Yeah,
I always have good questions.
I know you
I just wanted to know real quick about your opinion on why Western movies have such a limited audience. You're a maker
because
of Western, so you should have some kind of an idea.
You really want my opinion?
Yeah, I do.
You want the truth?
Mm-hmm. Well,
can you handle the truth?
Yeah, I can handle the truth. I can handle the truth!
Western movies, to me, are about America.
Mm-hmm.
And about heading west,
mm-hmm,
and about creating a life for you, and about people who work, and people who suffer, and people who strive for a dream. And the people today who want to do that, who want to strive for that dream, who want to work, who want to accomplish something, are too busy working, and they don't have time to watch
stories of their heritage.
You know, they don't have time to,
yeah,
watch Westerns. They will take time if it's a good one. But they are too busy working. They're not collecting welfare. They're not on unemployment. And they're not sitting at home watching The View. They're not watching rap music. They're not watching things that they don't want to do. They're,
mm-hmm,
out there hustling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, the Western is about independence. It's about freedom. It's about strong people. There's a book out called 101 Questions About the West. And one of the questions said, how did they handle cowards on a wagon train? And the answer was there were no cowards on a wagon train. The people,
right,
who were afraid or hesitant about it stayed back east.
Right.
The people that went out west went out and worked. And yes, some of them died because it's tough. It's rough. People don't understand that today when they talk about it. And I said, you know how rough it is to go across this country? And they go, well, it's nothing. I go to Vegas all the time. I said, really, try walking to Vegas. Don't go 80 miles an hour in an air-conditioned car. Try walking there and seeing what you have to go through. And that's the suffering that has to do. And that's human nature. So if you build a good script about I was thinking on my way down here, two of the movies that I really enjoy, which are not Westerns, but one is On the Waterfront.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's no special effects and On the Waterfront. I mean, there's a fist fight, there's fighting, but it's not, Marlon Brando doesn't do a triple flip over and kick the guy in the head. It's not what you see in a lot in movies. And a lot of people, they're just jumping on the bandwagon. And the other one I was thinking about, Casablanca. And I can only recall one gunshot in Casablanca, and that's at the end when Humphrey Bogart shoots the German. And I'm looking at, but what is so interesting about these movies? What is so great about them? It's the story and it's the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So if the writer took a Western and created a great story about great characters, not about some ridiculous thing that they do but everybody's talking about, well, it's music video time, it's this, you have to have quick cuts, you have to have action, you don't have to have that. You have to have a good story with good characters.
Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Hey, look, we only got a couple of minutes left. Why don't you give us your contact information?
Well, sure. It's our website is caravanwest.com, and I can always be reached at pshireko@gmail.com if people want to email me. And they can call Caravan West at 661-268-8300. and talk to me or order a book or a kid's book.
Or hire him to do his one-man Buffalo Bill show.
Or hire like, me to do my one like
or hire just, Caravan West like, to help you with your
exactly.
movie.
Right. Or commercial
yeah,
or
we did
any
now,
number
now
of
we
things.
Have, we have several shows coming out right now. So we just finished doing a Billy the Kid show, which was going to air on National Geographic Channel October 18th.
This is the second one you've done.
Several of them.
Yeah.
And again, this is the thing that I argue about. They always think that there's only four people in the Old West. Wyatt Earp, Wild Bill Hickok, Jesse James, and Billy the Kid. No! There are so many great stories about yeah. it, but this is what they want to do. Uh-huh. And one of the producers told me, he says, look, if this is selling at Walmart and you go in there and they go, hey, it's Billy the Kid Lawman, or think of any name, you know, John Jones, Fugitive, you know, they're going to go, well, I know who Billy the Kid is. I'll buy that movie. I don't know who John Jones is, so they won't buy that movie.
Yeah.
That's their
mm-hmm.
the
mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they do. So we did that. We just did a pilot for a series on the Travel Channel called Legendary Stories. And in the pilot, we did Wyatt Earp, Lewis and Clark, and the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. So they came out to the ranch to film all that
wow.
stuff, our 2,400-acre ranch mm-hmm. in Agodosi, mm-hmm. in the studio zone. Remember that.
Yes.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you for coming on with us tonight. You're welcome back anytime. You can call in anytime. Chat with us if you like.
Yeah, let us know what's going on.
I can call because, you know, I can't computer it.
Well, yeah, I know. But you can always pick up the phone.
Yep.
And we'll be here again next Thursday when Russ will be in for Bobby Jean. Who's in your next week?
Next week is an evening with Tracy Newman and the Reinforcements. It's going to be a really wonderful night of live music.
All right. Yeah, that's the concert series.
Concert series, SCB
right.
TV Out West Concert
right.
Series.
And Russ Avison is here with me next week, and we're going to be talking to a writer named Patrick Shanahan. And he's back east someplace. I don't know where he's at, but we'll find out. Anyway. Thanks for coming in again, Peter. And as our friend Court Joyner once said, sitting here in this very studio.
Right on and
fight on.
Fight on. We'll
and
see
with
you
that,
next week.
We are out of here.